We're going to reverse the order on you a little bit. We'll do 2897 first, and then start back up at the top. John, you want to give us a quick summary of open the hearing on 2897?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill would create a 13-member task force to examine the potential for extending the Washington County Commuter Rail Project to Salem. Membership would include legislators, mayors, county representatives, a representative from ODOT, and a representative from the railroad whose line will be used in Washington County for the commuter rail project there. The task force would be supported by staff provided by the Legislative Administration Committee and would report its findings to the legislative leadership by October 1st of 2006.
Great. Thank you very much. First two people, I'm assuming representatives, you'd like to come up together. Representative Crummell and Representative Grinley.
If we may, Mr. Chair.
We always like to go places together. But it's your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Breenlich, House District 33, and I really appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill this afternoon. And in fact, I'm not specifically asking you to pass this bill forward, at least at this time, but I really do think it's a marvelous opportunity to have a relatively brief hearing on this and to put on the record the fact that if we're going to move into the future in commuter rail, it's time to begin to thinking about it right now. We're in the midst of crafting the Washington County Commuter Rail. It has had its share of obstacles, most of which we've been able to overcome, and I'm convinced we'll be able to overcome any other obstacles, and several of us should be riding a train by 2007 and 2008. But as you think about a commuter rail line that moves from Beaverton to Wilsonville, it's almost inevitable to ask, why stop at Wilsonville? Why not keep coming to Salem? And the fact is, from a practical matter, it really makes a ton of sense. The right-of-way is there and intact. The cost for the Wilsonville to Beaverton is about 15 miles long. The expansion from Wilsonville to Salem would be about an additional 25 miles. But at current day cost, the original estimates are that the cost per mile would be about half of the cost of the original line for two reasons. One is the Wilsonville to Beaverton line required buying some right-of-way at the north end of it, and also there were far more grade crossings on that stretch per mile than there will be on the stretch coming down here. I've had several bills in this session that some of you have heard about, that we've talked about, that vision the future and imagine what the future can be like. And what's very clear is if we're talking about a similar time frame for the second part of this line, a time frame that's built on the time frame it took for the Wilsonville to Beaverton piece, we're talking about having the first ride on this train 2017-2018 if we start now. There's a story that is told about Napoleon calling in his arborist at one time and saying that he wanted to see this stretch of road looking in a particular way with his favorite sycamore trees over the road, and he had this vision. And the arborist told him in order to get the trees growing to look like he envisioned, it would take 100 years. And Napoleon stopped and looked at him and said, "Then start today." And basically, that's the situation we're in. If we're talking about something that could happen, if you can imagine riding from downtown here, a few blocks down, to the Beaverton Transit Mall, catching a max train to the airport, and perhaps at that time making that trip in an hour and 15, an hour and 20 minutes. If you can imagine what the traffic's going to be like in I-5, if we can't keep out I-5 and 205, trying to get to the airport, you can imagine how this will provide a transportation alternative that could really make it marvelous for the people in the Capitol, make it easy for the people in the metro area to get to the Capitol, and I suspect I'm not going to be around at that time, but there will be youngers of us who might still be around, and how it could enhance our experience here. We've already begun discussions with the mayors all along the route. We've gathered under the auspices of Congresswoman Hooley's office, the transit systems at the two ends of the line, the mayors, several of us in the legislature, the county folks, TriMet, ODOT, and others, and we are actually trying to move forward. I put this bill in so we have a bill if we needed it. I think at the moment we can make enough progress between now and the next session that we don't, but I really did want to have a chance to get this on the record, acknowledge that the ball is rolling, and hear some other people talking about it today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? No. Representative Krummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Krummel, House District 26, which includes Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. And with regards to House Bill 2897, thank you for having a hearing on this and for allowing me to come in and speak a little bit. I will try to be brief, but there's a few things that I'd like to, as Representative Greenlick talked about, get on the record as well. And hopefully the first project will be up and running by the time we would break ground here in Salem, so that there can be some lessons learned with regards to what worked and what didn't work in the beginning. But back in about 1992 or 93, after a mayor's prayer breakfast in Beaverton, a few of us, myself as mayor of Wilsonville Rob Drake was the mayor of Beaverton, and a few other folks. Lou Ogden was the mayor of Tualatin. Anyway, we got together in a parking lot, and we thought it would be just a great idea to start talking about this. And I had actually talked about the idea of a bullet train from Portland to Salem for quite a while. So we started talking about this idea of the first leg sort of being the Wilsonville to, or Beaverton to Wilsonville, and we would be able to tie into MAX there so that people could get into downtown or out to Hillsboro or wherever they maybe would need to go. We also had sort of a dream of having a section that would go from Newburgh over to Milwaukee, but we couldn't ever quite get Clackamas County to jump off the ledge with us. They seem to, Clackamas County has always been, for the last 15 years, pretty much tied into the idea of the light rail along the I-205 corridor, and they did not want to do anything that might seem to sort of compromise that, so they would not even come to the table to discuss the idea of going from Newburgh to Milwaukee, although the lines exist, and there would actually be a joint place in Tualatin where the two trains could meet. Not crash, just meet. And that's why the mayor of Sherwood was extremely interested in this project as well. We finally then, in 1997, decided to do a fatal flaw analysis. The cities and the county, Washington County, are the ones that pretty much kicked in the money for that. And some of the questions were, would there be sufficient ridership? Are there serious engineering impediments? What kind of legal obstacles might exist? And what, of course, are the railroad's attitudes? Because this is not a line that's owned by the county or the state. It is a line owned by Western and Pacific Railroad. However, they were very cooperative in this whole project. And one of the things that we discovered is that that line runs from Beaverton to Wilsonville, actually runs all the way to Salem. So the line is there. It's in place. Western and Pacific uses it today. We, in 1999, then started preparing some capital cost estimates and a number of other things, and then in 2000 and 2001 we were actually entered in the federal system as a New START project, and we started being able to get some money from the federal government, $1.1 million in 2001, and then another $1.5 million in 2002. The final design is now about 75% complete. We're hoping that it's going to open in 2008. and that about every 30 minutes, it's a 27-minute run from Wilsonville to downtown Beaverton. And that's with stops in Tualatin, at Washington Square, downtown Tigard, and then finally in Beaverton. So there's four stops along the way. We figure that it will carry about 3,000 weekday riders on average by the year 2020. We think that there's going to be 1,200 hours of travel time savings generated each weekday as compared to local and express bus service can provide now, and that's because they're avoiding congestion altogether. The total project cost is about $103.5 million. We estimated in 1992 that we could do commuter rail on existing line for about 10% of the cost of light rail. It is now lower than that. It's now more around 7.5 to 8% the cost of light rail, because that light rail, to run a light rail line, by the time you buy the right of way and lay the line and pay the money, pay all the money for all of the stuff that you have to do, you're looking at well over $1 billion. We're probably closer to $2 billion. So we think that this is a good way to get a lot of transit oriented system in place and not have to spend the kind of money that we have to spend on light rail, which means we can still put money into roads and pedestrian ways and bikeways and other modes of transportation, which I have always been an advocate of having a complete transportation system. Some of the lessons that we learned is that with regards to the feds, they definitely carefully weigh the strengths and weaknesses of any project, and so they're going to look carefully as far as getting involved. Working directly with the railroads is a very good thing to do, and getting them involved early is extremely, extremely important. And one of the things that I note in House Bill 2897, is it one of the people that's on here is a member of Western Pacific Railroad. I think since it's their right of way, we would be using, and we have to work with the rail with the freight trains. And I was told many years ago when we first started this project by then railroad director Claudia Howells that we were going to be in for a long haul because freight pays the rent, passenger traffic doesn't. So, trying to take over any freight lines was going to be real difficult. But Claudia also worked with us to make this thing happen. As far as an operating entity is concerned, it's very important that you focus on the construction costs and financial plans, and not to lose sight of that. But at some point in time, the decision has to be made as far as who's going to operate the system, and then the partners. Getting partners involved is extremely important. So along that Western and Pacific rail line between Wilsonville and Salem, it's extremely important that we have buy-in from the cities that are along the way. St. Paul, Woodburn, Donald, Kaiser, as we're getting closer to the south, and then other cities that I've probably missed. Getting the business folks involved is extremely important in this kind of a project as well. And then momentum. And once we get momentum going for this thing, let's not hold up. We've got to be relentless, and we've got to. Momentum is easy. It's hard to develop, but it's very easy to lose. And that's one of the things that we want to keep in mind as we move forward with this kind of a project. I'm enthused. I think that from my perspective, this is a dream. I know it sounds kind of quirky to say it's a dream that somebody's had for a long, long time. But it's an idea that early in the time that I was mayor of Wilsonville, I talked about the idea of a bullet train between Portland and Salem. I think running from Beaverton to Salem is, it's just as good. And if we can get people down the way here, we should. Let me just point out one other thing. The city of Wilsonville Smart Systems, South Metro Area Rapid Transit System, it's a bus system that is funded solely by Wilsonville businesses. And they pay half of what they would pay if they were in TriMet. Smart has been offering, and this was at my insistence when I was mayor of Wilsonville, an express bus service between Wilsonville and Salem since about 1994-95. It's been successful. Matter of fact, we have a lot of people here in the building that ride that bus. And I've heard it referred to as Jerry's bus. I'm not so sure that it necessarily should be referred to as Jerry's bus, but I am glad that the system offers that way of being able to get down here. I have ridden it many times myself, not just here to the Capitol, but when I was working over in West Salem. I used to try to ride it at least once a week. And I found that it was a very good service. But I'll tell you, if we could put that on a train and get even the buses off the road, I think we would be further ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, it can be Mitch and Jerry's train. Huh?
Hey, there you go. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at the rate that Beaverton is annexing, Beaverton may soon be the larger city in the Portland metropolitan area. Anyway, that may make it a logical connection. No comment required. Hopefully we got several bills done.
That wasn't the question.
Yeah.
Right?
I am interested in terms of the point at which it would come into Salem. Do you envision that it would come in at a point where it would be a connection point with the Amtrak service that would then be able to go
no.
north or especially south?
No. It would be State Street at the foot of the foot of State Street. That's where the track goes.
So if I could follow up. Yeah. So is there a way, do you envision that as a piece? Because that would seem to be a logical piece to connect those two passenger pieces together, a commuter rail coming down from Washington County and the Amtrak service that comes into Salem already.
I'll take a shuttle.
Okay.
I think if I may jump in here, and I, this is one of those sorts of things, and why, Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, why you would have a task force to really look at this, because one of the things you would want to do is talk to the city of Salem and say, where do you want this thing to go into? I mean, do you want it to go into the foot of State Street, or do you want them to throw a switch and run it to the regular Amtrak station? If you run it to the Amtrak station, you've already got a connection with bus, you've already got a connection with the train running on down to, well, actually San Diego. I mean, you can take, because you can take Amtrak all the way south, but there's some real options there. But if it did come into the foot of State Street, as Representative Greenlick is suggesting, having chariots provide a shuttle between there and wherever else people, you know, so you have your buses ready to meet the train. That's the one thing that we're doing in Wilsonville and the cities along the way between Wilsonville and Beaverton, is that in Wilsonville, SMART will be there to meet the train and be ready to take people out in the community, excuse me, wherever they may need to go. At the other locations, TriMet is going to be there, and they're going to time their buses so that at those transit stations, the buses are there, so when people need to get to wherever, Nike or Columbia Sportswear, or if they're in Tigard and needing to get over to Washington Square, at Washington Square, or they're in Tualatin and needing to get over to Meridian Park Hospital, wherever the case is that they're needing to get, so you want the buses there ready to pick people up and take them.
If I can add, Mr. Chair, just a comment that Representative Crone made. The railroad, in this case, is very interested, and they've been very supportive of these discussions. Their perspective is that the improvement in the track for passenger rail then makes it far more available for freight rail in between the time, the other 20 hours a day that you're not running the commuter rail. So they're very excited about the prospects.
Yeah, I guess the only concern that pops up for me, and I think my understanding is that the dollars that would be being pursued for this ultimately at the state level or at the federal level would not be competing with the dollars being pursued for, as you represented, Crumble, the light rail coming into northern Clackamas County. Because I think one of the reasons our region has been so strong is as a region, starting off saying we're going to go to Gresham first and then get that done, and then as a region saying we're going to go out to Washington County next and getting that done. And now the commitment is, as you said, to come down 205 and into Milwaukee, downtown Milwaukee. And so my understanding is, and I guess I would just express the hope that we don't get into a situation where we're competing against the same set of dollars. Hopefully we can be advancing all these.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, I would think Now, you notice I'm not going to assume here. I'm just going to think that that probably it would not be competing, because by the time this would be on the Fed's radar screen, I would hope that the commitment for the light rail in Clackamas County is already appropriated and already taken care of. The other thing is that we would also hope that for the first leg, that from Beaverton to Wilsonville is already funded. Now, that's already funded with a $35 million bond from the state. And I know that there's already been a commitment from the feds as well for, what is it, about $50 million. So, give or take a couple of million. Anyway, the key, I think, is making sure that these projects can be moving along. But I think having another project in the pipeline is always a good idea.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Fred Nussbaum.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Fred Nussbaum. I'm here representing AORTA, the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates. I am a resident of Washington County, and I took the bus down to this hearing today. Not the Wilsonville bus, but the throughway bus that's operated by Amtrak with funding from the state of Oregon. And I'm hoping that we can expand all forms of public transportation between the Portland metro area and Salem and beyond. So I'm here to testify in favor of the concept that Representative Greenlich has put forward here, that we do need to study the extension of the commuter rail to Salem, whether that's a special task force or a directive to the Department of Transportation to do that. Let's see, 11 years ago we had a advisory committee that helped put the Amtrak service, the Cascade service, online here. So the two extra trains per day between Portland, Eugene, and the throughway buses that complement that, as well as the throughway buses that connect the corridor with outlying communities. That was done with an in-house advisory committee within ODOT, so that's another way of looking at this. So the important message is we need to start looking at this issue now and not wait, or it will be 2018 before we see anything running. Now, other communities have had experiences where it's only taken them 2.5 years to put in commuter rail. For instance, Vancouver, B.C., has a 10-mile rail line they put in 1996, I believe, somewhere around there. It took them 2.5 years to get that up and running. Actually, 18 months for them. Average is about 2.5 years. So we're in favor of all kinds of transportation. They're not in competition with each other. Light rail has a place in the urban area. The Amtrak service has a place connecting cities for longer distances. Commuter rail has a place for shorter distances. And if you look at the traffic on I-5 between Portland and Salem, you can tell that there is a demand for more transportation between Portland and Salem. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. Questions?
No? Okay. Kelly Taylor.
She'll
be back in.
Hey, Mr. Chair, because it's not related to testimony yet, I just wanted to be perfectly safe and declare a potential conflict in that my company has done business both as a contractor and a subcontractor on rail projects, and this could possibly be obtusely related, but I just want to make sure that was stated for the record.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor. I'm the administrator of the Rail Division at the Department of Transportation, and I just wanted to put a few comments on record that we have been involved in meetings throughout the years on both the Washington County Commuter Rail Project. I'm heavily involved with that with both TriMet and Washington County as they're working through the issues. And we've also been involved in meetings with City of Salem, City of Kaiser, Washington County recently came down and was sort of giving them the, you know, here's our hindsight to be your foresight, which is really, really valuable, because that's how you do shrink down those years, if at all possible, in not stumbling into the same problems. So I just wanted you to know that we're there and we're working with them, and there's a lot of people excited about it. I do have people ask me, gee, is the commuter rail going to come down to Salem? And I said, I don't know, but you know, I hope so. I think it would be a really good thing for Oregon. So just wanted you to know that.
Thank you, Kelly. Questions? Nope. Anyone else to testify on 2897? I'll close the public hearing on 2897. And open a public hearing on 2110. John?
Mr. Chair, this is a bill that would create a rail advisory committee to advise ODOT on issues related to rail facilities and service in Oregon. The proposed seven-member committee would include representatives from the Class 1 railroads, the short line railroads, passenger railroads, rail passengers, local governments, ports, and industries that transport goods by rail. Policy and staff would be provided by ODOT at an estimated cost of about $54,000 for the upcoming biennium. The bill would also require the committee to meet at least three times a year, and the bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, John. Kelly, I guess you can come back up and bring Bruce along.
Mr. Chair, shall I so state my
no.
conflict again?
No.
Just to be
so
well,
stated on the record.
For the other bill, yep. Not on this bill.
That's
be right. Okay.
business. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'll be very brief here in my remarks. I just want to let you know that I appreciate you hearing this bill this morning, excuse me, this afternoon. And again, this is a bill that was introduced at our request because we do believe that we need a committee that can advise us on rail issues. However, since this bill has been introduced, we've had a number of discussions with the stakeholder groups, including the railroads, and I think we have a plan B, which I'd like to turn over to Ms. Taylor and ask her to go through her testimony and explain to you what she would like to do to accomplish this need that we have.
Thank you, Bruce. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Kelly Taylor with the ODOT Rail Division. I've been with the department 27 years, a long time, but I've only been in the rail division since last July. And this bill was actually proposed and introduced going through the process before I got there. There are many, many advisory committees to the department from all over, from all different issues. Some are one time, sort of on one issue, some are ongoing. And the thought was, you know, we've got some pretty good relationships out there with different stakeholder groups, and that was the thought behind this bill, to do something for rail. And since I've been in the job for 9 months or so, it really would be a good forum to have a regular structure of all of both Class 1s, short lines, shippers, the ports, passenger and freight, talking about all of the issues at the same time coming to the table rather than sort of piecemeal the way it's happened through the years. And so we definitely think that this is a good thing to do. But it doesn't have to be in statute. And frankly, there are pros and cons to whether you put something in statute or whether you do something by the commission. Some folks view that if it's in statute, it's a little stronger, it's permanent, et cetera, it doesn't get changed as easily. But that's just the point. If it is not in statute and done by the commission, you can change it when the change is needed at a much less cost than putting a bill through the process, as you all know. So there is some benefit to not putting in the statute. And we're perfectly comfortable with it not being in statute. But we've talked with the various stakeholders, the labor unions, the railroads, et cetera, and they really, really do think this is a good idea to have something on a regular basis, get together and talk through issues. It's been extremely helpful, like at the Motor Carrier Division and things, with the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee to work through policy issues, especially when they've had to downsize some of their services and change the way they do business, to have a regular forum for the stakeholders to weigh in on and give their input. So we think it would be a good thing to do for the Rail Division as well. So I would ask you not to support the bill, but to support the forum formation of the rail committee by the Oregon Transportation Commission. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can see for a lot of committees you might radically change focus 10 years down the road just in terms of public policy. I guess as I look at the mandate of this committee, this advisory committee, it looks like the needs around financing improvements to rail facilities are not going to go away, tragically. wish we could get them all adequately funded, but I don't anticipate that going away. Statewide and regional policies and actions that affect rail facilities, policy and planning that affect rail facilities, the need for improvements to rail facilities. I guess I'm not seeing for this particular one how the mandate could change. I mean, it seems like it's a general enough mandate that's going to be true 10 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now. So I guess I'm not really understanding the concern about all the cost and hassle it would be to have to change it if it were adopted statutorily. What that would be.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not so much around the mandate, but perhaps the construction of the committee itself, the members. You know, it's the way the bill was drafted, it came up with 7 members, and you could try to do 10, or you could try to say 12. So it's that sort of thing. It's just the charter of the group, its formation, and how many are on there and who's on there. It would be more flexible if it were not in statute. And, of course, that could, you're right, you could draft language that would be broad for that, too. It's just that the concern was, gee, do we have to put another committee statute? In fact, I had one lobbyist that had expressed concern to me about putting it in statute, really in favor of another committee. And I said, you know, actually none of them need to be in statute for that matter. And he said, you know, we should write a bill and take them all out of statute. And I said, go for it. Don't know it'll get very far, but you could try.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pat Egan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Pat Egan, we're wearing two hats today. One is for the Port of Portland, and we're supportive of the concept in 2110, however implemented, and with the Oregon Rail Users League. And I'll be as brief as I can. Oregon Rail Users League, as some of you may know, is a very new organization, just elected a board a few weeks ago. And the concept there has been to try to get all of the rail users of whatever kind, whether they're shippers, passenger advocates, freight advocates, the class ones and the short lines themselves, all at the same table to try to define a common agenda and advocate for the interests of rail of all types. That's advocating is a different thing than sort of vetting through public policy, which I would think that the Rail Advisory Committee ultimately would do. And I think this could be a very useful tool, not just to the general public, but specifically to this committee and to others like it that are trying to get an objective view of the various issues that that rail brings up. It's growing, as many of you know. Freight overall is growing, and I think it's going to be, as to Representative Hunt's comments, I don't think this is an issue that's going away. It hasn't gone away for the last 100, and I don't think it will go away for the next 100. Last thing I'd say is that obviously, as far as the bill goes, we would like to see a rail advisory committee, whether it's directly implemented by legislation or by the department, I think is up to you to decide. One thing I guess I would add is that the Freight Advisory Committee, which originally was put together by the department in cooperation with all of the stakeholders, I think existed for 2, maybe 3 years before the legislature put a stamp of approval, put it into statute, and that may be a proper way to go here. Again, it's up to you, but considering that this is a new entity, I trust certainly Bruce Warner. I think he's doing a great job, and I think they can move forward in either fashion. Thank you very much, and happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Questions? Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
Brad, it's your turn again.
I'm going to be very brief. AORTA is also a member of ORUL, Oregon Rail Users League, so everything that Pat said we're firmly behind. Yes, we are behind the concept of this bill. Again, we don't care whether it is a statutory advisory committee or whether it is something within under the Oregon Transportation Commission. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There is testimony that's being distributed to you. I think I faxed to the committee earlier, but we made other copies again. So, thank you.
Thank you, Fred. Dan Armstrong.
Mr. Chair, members, Ken Armstrong. I'm here representing the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association and also the Oregon Ports Group. Both organizations participate in the Rail Users League, which you heard Mr. Egan talk about. And I was going to spend a little bit of my time talking about the Freight Advisory Committee, which Mr. Egan mentioned, and just kind of the what ended up happening with that. And I won't go into much detail other than to reiterate what he said, that we had originally had that established as a committee. committee to serve at the pleasure of the chair or of the director of the Transportation Department, then Grace Cronican, and that did exist for a couple of years, worked very well. It moved into a statutory structure just because that ended up seeming to better fit the need at the time. But I think that for both of the clients I'm representing today, the Rail Advisory Committee, whether it be in statute, whether it be at the pleasure of the commission, is from a policy standpoint is an important thing to have within the department. And you'll find support from my clients, and we want to endorse the concept and be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you very much.
Bob Russell. Good, D.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association. Al Elkins was also intending to be here, but unfortunately he had a meeting outside the building, so he couldn't attend today. This is kind of interesting, testifying on a bill that nobody's quite sure if they want or not. But I think that the point that we'd like to make is still worth making. From our perspective, the rail industry and the department should have whatever committees they need to work effectively together. We have absolutely no concern about that at all. And I'm not just being altruistic here. The trucking industry has a huge stake in the efficient operation of our rail system. Today, over 40% of the tonnage moved by rail comes from the trucking industry. So we would support anything that is helpful to the rail industry. In the past, it's probably true, and many of you are probably aware of it, that trucking and rail viewed each other more as competitors than anything else. Those days are gone. I believe today that we more accurately see each other as partners, along with air, pipeline, and marine freight industries to support our state and national economies. We are the foundation. We must make the economy work, is the freight transportation industries. You've already been told that in 2001, the legislature created the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. And that's been a very positive development in terms of the system as a whole. The purpose of the committee is to advise the department about issues, policies, and programs that impact multimodal freight mobility in Oregon. And attached to my testimony, you'll find the statute that actually creates the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. In addition, the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee may make recommendations to the Commission for Freight Mobility Projects. However, priority is to be given to multimodal projects. It's the connectivity between the modes that is the emphasis of the Freight Advisory Committee. All of the freight modes have been represented on the Freight Advisory Committee. I believe that the Freight Advisory Committee has been very successful and has proven to be very useful to the department. Following the passage of OTIA 3, all of the modes worked together to select $300 million worth of local bridge projects and nearly $100 million in freight mobility projects. Priority was given to multimodal projects. Matter of fact, the number one project on our freight mobility list was a project requested by the Burlington Northern Railroad to help improve the highway connection between them, or their intermodal yard on Eon Avenue and Highway 30. That project is yet to be built, but it's in development. The Commission adopted without change the recommendations of the Freight Advisory Committee, and they certainly expressed their appreciation for the work that we did. The Oregon Trucking Association strongly supports a multimodal freight transportation system. I think you've heard in other hearings that most forecasters are predicting that the volume of freight is going to double between now and 2020. It's going to take all of the modes working together efficiently and effectively if we're going to meet that challenge for 2020. Our concern with House Bill 2110, and it doesn't matter if it's in statute or if it's created administratively, is that it would establish a committee for a single mode that is virtually identical to the Freight Advisory Committee. And I believe it is very important that the modes stay in the same room and continue to work together. And that way we will have a total system that works best for Oregon and for the region. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. That concludes my written testimony.
Questions, Obama?
No. Okay, Dee.
Yeah, for the record, I'm Dee Bridges. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. I don't have a lot to add here. I came up here intending to be in opposition to the bill. I now found myself in support of the concept everybody else is in support of. And I'd only like to add that I'm a member of the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. I would like to see that committee strengthened and not weakened. Our original opposition to this bill was that it had a very real risk of weakening that committee. I'd rather see the committee strengthened, not weakened. I'm also a member of MCTAC, Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. That's a committee that's been talked about earlier. MCTAC meets regularly, advises the Motor Carriers Division on regulatory matters and anything else that affects the trucking industry. Works extremely well. I think the Motor Carriers Division would agree that it does, and they get a lot of benefit out of that. I think having said that, you can certainly see where the rail division could benefit from the same type of committee, and we're certainly not in opposition to that.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both. Cindy Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm here representing Union Pacific Railroad, which I'm very proud to do. I wanted to just say really briefly, because I think you've heard just about everything you need to hear, that like the fly to the farm or the kid to the Christmas tree, rail needs no incentives to come and join with our partners and talk about rail issues in Oregon. We will be here whether it's statutory or whether it's something done by the commission. However, I would say that the committee that we're talking about in this bill is not the same as the Freight Advisory Committee, and it fills a very specific need that the Freight Advisory Committee can help us to further but won't do in total. The Freight Advisory Committee is about freight mobility. The Rail Advisory Committee would deal with people, and it would deal with other issues besides just mobility. Rail in Oregon is at a totally different point in its world than, say, the Trucking Association. The Trucking Association and the truckers therein don't have to worry about who's going to pay for the roads. We have to worry about who's going to pay for the rail. We have to worry about who's going to pay for the different stations. We have to worry about who's going to pay for safety crossing upgrades. We have a lot of concerns that are very different than mobility. And we also have to worry a little bit about our competition when it comes to things like a weight mile tax versus a diesel tax. We have to do a lot of different things Freight Advisory Committee would be conflicted doing. So we're happy to have any kind of committee we can have. It's imperative that these people talk, but it does not have to be statutory. I just want to make sure and get on the record that we are partners to some extent. This is just a few different needs.
Thank you, Cindy. Question? Good. Anyone else to testify on 2110? Close the hearing on 2110 and open the hearing on 2576. Don?
Mr. Chair, as introduced, this bill would prohibit persons from transporting a boat on a public road without removing all vegetation from either the sides or undersides of the boat. Violators would be subject to a fine of $90. The bill resulted from the interim work of a noxious weed task force, which found that invasive vegetation species can often be transported from one body of water to another when they become attached to a boat. Such species can cause ecological damage to the new body of water if they detach from the boat that transported them from another source.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. The committee administrator is very correct. This is one of three bills that came out of our Noxious Weeds Task Force and our work group that met again in this last interim. It does me no pleasure and goes against my libertarian side to bring you a bill that creates an additional restriction. This is one of the great conundrums of public policy, to be sure. You have to address issues, however, that are real. And one of the real issues are that noxious weeds, invasive weed species, are becoming more and more prevalent in the state of Oregon. There is no question about that. And unfortunately, they are in many ways choking our rivers and streams. And it has become apparent, and became apparent in discussions in our task force and our work group, that this one of the ways that invasive weed species are transported across the state is when a boater, no matter who it is, pulls that boat out of the water and drives on down the road with weeds hanging over the trailer or the boat, and they fall off and they grow. Or he gets it home and he pulls them off and tosses it over there on the side of the flower bed, and next thing you know, there's some weed growing there. And if he doesn't pay attention to it, it flowers, and then it spreads, and then you've got the beginnings of a mild epidemic. So we decided that this was going to be one of the areas we thought we could address. And what this bill does is it empowers a Marine Patrol officer or a law enforcement officer to simply go to someone if they're there by the boat ramp when they're pulling their boat out, saying, "Hey, you shouldn't transport all those weeds down the road. You might want to just kind of take them off." And that's what the intent of this bill is. Now, they can say that today. Okay, they certainly have the ability to do that, but they don't have the force of law to say, you know, that's against the law now, you can't do that. And I hate to do this. I don't like, just not one bit. I grudgingly come before you to bring this idea up. But if we don't do something, if we don't move forward on the ideas that we have to manage this problem, and this is a management problem now, giving the authority to agencies to manage and hopefully highlight to individuals that this is a problem and that you need to be careful about your boating. Now, hopefully, by also, there's another benefit in doing this, and that if we pass this piece of legislation, that it then can be part of the training syllabus when you go to get your boating license. So there's an awareness factor then that will happen as a result of this that isn't necessarily happening now today. And I think that in itself has value. To be able to say to people, you know, one of the problems we have are boats that are being transported across the state that have weeds hanging on them because it creates issues down the road. And you can't do that. It is now against the law. So we do have some amendments that the agency, the Marine Board, worked with us. We decided that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that it probably would be wise to really put this into the vehicle code as opposed to the Marine Code, because there are more deputies and state patrol officers that will potentially see boats and trailers than there will be county marine officers, typically. So I thought that was a reasonable idea. And we decided to work with the verbiage a little bit in Section 2 of the amendment, the dash 1, which says a person may not transport a boat on a public road if the person knowingly fails to remove a substantial amount of any aquatic vegetation, rather, adhering to the boat's hull below the gunwales, the boat propulsion system, or the boat trailer. And the idea there was we would add the terms knowingly and substantial so that there is, a law enforcement officer has some discretion here. because the last thing I want to have happen is an innocent person pulling their boat out of the water that's just forgotten, or maybe they haven't seen, they've got some weeds hanging off, and a deputy writes up and, I found you, you're violating the law here, so let me write you a little citation here. The idea is to give them the flexibility to just kind of warn them about it and say, yeah, you can't do that anymore. They passed a bill, and that crazy legislature passed this bill. And
great.
And I can say that because I are one. It's just, again, it's designed to give some flexibility here for law enforcement officers to look at this and just use it kind of as an informational type awareness circumstance. Now, you'll probably hear some testimony here from a good friend of mine who just literally brought up a good point to me about how there are some in the duck hunting realm, of which I am a duck hunter, that there are some camouflage materials that you could actually put on your boat that probably would qualify as being prohibited under this statute. So in that regard, certainly common sense would dictate that those are not the types of weeds we're addressing here. Dead weeds that are used as camouflage netting or so forth are not what we're after here, to be clear. We're after the weeds that are growing aquatic vegetation that is fresh and gets caught on the gunwales or the prop or on your trailer as you're backing your boat. That's really what we're after here more than anything. And so I'm, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm certainly attentive to and would be willing to consider reasonable amendments to make the bill as good as we can possibly make it.
Representative. Yes, Representative Green.
Well, just a comment. It's kind of the part two to some of the legislation in the last few years that required the big ships to clean their bilges out so that they don't transport, green mitten crabs or whatever, certain vegetation and animals and species. Thank you. And I think that it you left out lakes, and that's one of the things. Lakes, there's a whole culture of lakes people, and transporting a boat from one lake to another can, with one little piece of that stuff, I can't remember what it's called, it's the stuff you put in your fish tank, and it can take over a lake and just choke it out, these weeds. So it's very important that this is more than just education. I hope that the officers would use, maybe they could even put one of those little signs up where they put where the fish are, the fishing signs, so you know what you can get and not get in fishing, and to say, remove your weeds or something like that.
Thank you. Further questions? Oh, my goodness. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, Representative Krupp, your libertarian credentials are safe.
I don't know.
Liberty for noxious weeds, I don't think any of us would agree. I think you're good. My thought was exactly going the direction that Representative Boone was talking about. Do we already have statute in terms of boats and trailers related to the invasive species part of the equation? This deals with invasive noxious weeds, vegetation part of the equation. Maybe that's because we already have the statutory prohibitions.
I think it's the ocean going and river, big river, your river.
Yeah, and that may be another, because I know in the upper Great Lakes they've dealt with the zebra mussel and other invasive species that have just wiped out all kinds of operations they've been trying to do there, much in the way that noxious weeds can do it as well. And I don't know, maybe it's a question for our committee staff to follow up on that. If we're dealing with it related to invasive vegetation, we want to look at it in terms of invasive species for the same reason.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, to my knowledge, we don't, but I think it's an excellent question for legislative council. They certainly, when they were drafting this legislation for us, they did not indicate that there is sufficient statute or rule already in existence that would cover this particular issue, and that's why we went ahead and drafted this. We were frankly hoping we could do this by rule as opposed to having to pass a law. But it appears that we need to go down this road if we want to try to get a handle on this.
Representative Prue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I appreciate your libertarian hesitation on this as well. As Representative Boone and Representative Hunt alluded to, I think the larger picture when we look at ships coming from overseas and clearing the ballast and making sure they're not dumping, for example, the crabs that are so pervasive along the South Oregon coast right now. My question, because you were part of this, if I understand correctly, part of this work group, is there demonstrable evidence that you could share a little bit of, at least some flavor of events like this happening in Oregon causing harm in Oregon? I realize we can always say there's a potential, but has there been a track record? Are there specific instances that you can cite or that the work group could cite to justify this at that time? Because I had the same reservations about this that you do. Nobody wants to lose a lake or a river or anything else because of weed species. But I think this is asking a lot from where we are now. So it'd be nice when my uncle, one of my uncles who's a fishing guide, says, "What in the heck were you thinking, Scott?" I can say, "Well, listen, there was a work group, and here's what's going on."
And Mr. Chair and Representative Brune, I was hoping I could get out of here without answering that question, actually, but to be honest with you, nothing more than anecdotal evidence from a number of the individuals in the work group and individuals who had related stories. And, of course, we all know our own personal experiences being on the water, that it happens. There's no doubt about it. And so it's are there statistical analysis or evidence to indicate that? No, there isn't. I'd have to go back and look at the actual work in the work group and the task force, but I don't believe anyone came up with actual statistics that would indicate precisely what you're asking. It's more anecdotal in nature, again, and it's more, you know, again, kind of going back to our own personal experiences of being around waterways and, you know, weeds get caught on boats, and so we know it happens. It's just a matter of can you quantify it? No, we certainly can't, and that causes me some discomfort. I have to be quite honest with you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of the issue, and I'm sure you and I will agree on this, is using a sledgehammer to solve a problem that doesn't require that. I just, as an example, and you mentioned duck hunting, how about any four-wheel drive that is out in the woods or out in the fields doing any bird hunting, camping, and comes out of there with weeds and foliage? It may not be lake foliage, but it's certainly weeds that could be alive, that could be transferred. I'm not asking for an answer. I go, that's my hesitation with this. But it sounds like from your testimony that your work group went down every avenue that it thought it could, as far as education, as far as maybe postings at rivers and lakes to address this issue, short of a new law, a new statute. And it sounds like, if just reiterate, it sounds like your committee said that's just not the best way to do it.
Well, and a great question and comment, Mr. Chair and Representative Brune. The problem is local governments have to take this issue seriously enough, and I'm not saying they don't, because we have these great local weed control boards at the county level. But the problem is, in terms of posting, let's say at boat ramps throughout the state, that would have to be done on an individual county basis. They would choose to do that today. And because there is no formal rule or no formal statute, what are they going to say? They could put up a sign saying, you know, it's a bad idea to, or please remove weeds because it causes problems for others with invasive weed species, and it's how it's transported, and blah blah blah. But there would be no consistency with that. There would be no reason for that, and we're not calling for that to happen here either, by the way. I would rather that did happen. I would rather that maybe the Association of Oregon Counties would take this upon themselves and say, hey, you know, instead of having to pass a bill, why don't we agree that we as counties will go ahead and spend a little money and make up signs and put them in boat ramps? That would be a better direction in my mind. The problem was we felt there would be no consistency and no real reason for them to do that, no impetus to move them forward to make that happen. And that's part of the problem of how you get your handle on this entire subject of invasive weed species, is you almost have to make it illegal to do certain things to get people to sit up and take notice. I would much rather believe me, I would much rather not have to bring this bill before you. If we could find a way to do that, and if you can suggest a way, believe me, I'm all ears. I'll be happy to withdraw this bill if we can find a way to get this done some other way. Thank you.
Further questions?
Yeah.
Just, well, maybe an idea, and Paul's probably going to come up here anyway, but maybe the Marine Board could help out with that.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, I think that's an outstanding idea and would love to have their participation. In fact, I drafted up this amendment largely at their request, and I appreciate their involvement in looking at the legislation. So I am not wedded to this concept to the point that I certainly won't listen to other ideas and alternatives that might come along. If there's another way we can do it, again, I am more than happy to entertain what those might be. And I would advise anyone who's listening or anyone in the audience who has ideas to bring them forward, and I'll certainly entertain them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate it.
Randy Henry?
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, my name is Randy Henry with the Oregon State Marine Board. Thank you for allowing the Marine Board to talk on this opportunity about House Bill 2576. The Oregon Marine Board does agree with the sponsor of the legislation that transfer of aquatic vegetation from one water body to another should be controlled to prevent the spread of invasive species. Recreational boating activities, as I think you'll hear more from Mark Sisma with PSU Center for Lakes and Reservoirs, recreational boating as we've seen here in Oregon and in states with aquatic nuisance species infestations, can be a significant vector for unwanted vegetation. Once established, these species have serious economic and environmental consequences. Any laws that seek to prevent the spread of the aquatic vegetation need to be effective, but we must also balance that against penalizing boaters who may make reasonable effort to comply with the law. House Bill 2576 is one effort to prevent the spread of nuisance aquatic vegetation. In its original form, though, we felt that the language was incomplete and overly simplified. We've reviewed laws in force in Washington, Minnesota, and other states that have significant infestations and concerns. We've talked with officials from these states, and based on their comments and our discussions within the state's Invasive Species Council, we proposed several amendments to the sponsor, and we're pleased that most of those were considered. First, the original language in HB 2576 addressed only aquatic vegetation on the sides and bottom of the boat. The amended version was broadened to include the boat hull below the gunwales, the trailer, and the motor system, since these are the most significant collection points for aquatic weeds. We support this amendment. Also, the original language required removal of all vegetation from the boat. And while this is desired, it's probably not realistic. If you've ever crabbed in the coastal estuaries, you know that seaweed tends to fragment and you get little pieces all over the place. As enforced, that the law would require boaters to scour their boat at the boat ramp. This could be a significant problem. It would be difficult to comply with, and you're going to be clogging up traffic patterns there. So the goal really is to have a tool that will encourage boaters to take the time to, by hand, remove most of that vegetation from their boat. Again, we support the amendment that was proposed. We also proposed that law enforcement have the discretion to require a boater to remove vegetation from the boat. If they saw them on the road, it wasn't maybe enough to sight that they could pull them over and ask them or require them to remove it. We think this is still covered within the amendments. The bill generated one further question, and that was where this bill should revise in the Marine Code or in Transportation Code. We support the -1 amendment that moves it to the Vehicle Code. The Oregon State Marine Board, the Oregon Invasive Species Council, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and other state and federal agencies really are engaged in public information and education campaigns currently to prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species, including plants and animals. This law would be our first enforcement tool to back up the educational efforts specifically for aquatic plants. It would give law enforcement a tool to stop boats on public roadways, boats that may be coming here from other states, as well as moving things within our own state. We have worked with other organizations, and we have our own education campaigns to educate people about aquatic nuisance species, including hydrilla and milfoil, that we would want to keep out of our lakes. We've produced identification keychains. We have material in our boater education program. We have information on our website that helps identify it and give people good basic information on how to remove these from their boat, how to ensure that they don't spread this material. We produce this material. We hand it out broadly. It's featured material at our boat show every year for the past 5 or 6 years, I believe. And it's something that we feel very strongly in. Obviously, when lakes are choked by these weeds, it affects boating all the way around, and that affects the economy as well as the environment. So it is something we're concerned about and we're working with. But that enforcement tool, being able to have a law enforcement officer look for a flagrant violator or look for a person who's ignorant of the law and help them understand the need for that. Our enforcement program often says education through enforcement, and this is a good opportunity for that. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have at this time.
Thank you, Randy. Questions?
Randy. Maybe I'm just thinking of some of the old fishermen in my district.
Yes.
Who may or may not have access to a computer or want to, and just get in their boat and get on the river or the bays or whatever. And so that's why I thought maybe a sign might be a good idea. And is that something you think the Marine Board could take up?
Certainly. Several of the committees have produced, or several of the different work groups have produced signs addressing zebra mussels, for example. There are general signs about aquatic nuisance species in general. You'll see them up and down the coast at the major access points. There's probably more that we can do, and we'd be glad to work with the representative or State Invasive Species Council or other organizations to enhance that.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask you the same question I asked earlier in terms of the species side of the whole invasive spectrum. Do we have, in terms of the enforcement officers, existing statute that enables them to, that basically prohibits any invasive species? I realize this is dealing with plants.
Right.
Invasive species from boats.
As I understand, on the wildlife side with zebra mussels, with various fish species, those are covered in the wildlife integrity laws through the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Terrestrial invasive species, I believe, are covered by the Department of Agriculture. Aquatic species, I think that, I guess I'm not sure. They're not very clear if they are, and this would clarify that. In my research, I haven't seen things specific to aquatic species.
Could you define for me aquatic species? When you say aquatic species,
plants.
Are you saying just plants?
I'm talking about plants. Plants is the one thing that we feel like we need this hook for.
Okay.
Further questions? Thank you. Mark, I can't pronounce your last name. You're going to have to tell me how when you get up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a very common problem. My name is Mark Sitzma. I'm the Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Engineering at Portland State University and the Director of the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs. I work closely with Department of Ag on aquatic weed issues. I was a member of the Noxious Weeds Task Force that Representative Krupp chaired, and I'm a member of the Invasive Species Council. I'm also the person people call when they get weeds in their lakes and they want to know, okay, now what do we do? And I have submitted written testimony, but I thought I would just answer some of the questions that I've heard posed here. One is a question about signs. I have 5,000 signs in a storage room in my office ready to go up. I have one out in my truck, and I debated bringing it in, but it's like that big, and I thought, it shows a picture of people pulling weeds off of a boat, and it says, don't transport aquatic nuisance species. So signs, we've got that covered. There will be signs at boat ramps. There are already some, but we've sort of standardized all the signs. Randy mentioned the question about whether weeds are covered or animals are covered. The wildlife integrity rules are pretty clear. It says it's illegal to transport zebra mussels in the state of Oregon, for example. You can't possess them. You can't transport them. Weeds are kind of they fall in the cracks. There's no real statutory prohibition against transporting weeds on boats to moving them around between lakes. So that's why the bill was proposed, I think. In terms of the statistical question that came up about do we have any you know, definitive answers about what's the problem. We actually do. Department of Ag in about 2000 and 2001, somewhere around there, had an economic assessment of weeds, or they produced an economic assessment of weeds, and one of those weeds was Egeria densa, which is the plant that you can buy in aquarium stores, and it's called Brazilian Elodea. And I have a standing bet with anybody that if you go to a lake on the Oregon coast and it's got a boat ramp, if you go out any depth less than 15 feet and you're reaching the water, you'll pull out Egeria densa. It's in every lake, thousands and thousands of acres. Ten Mile Lake, Silk Coos, all those lakes are clogged by that particular noxious weed. The conclusion from this economic assessment that's about $3.5 million impact on the Oregon economy each year by that particular weed. Spartina is a weed in estuaries. The potential impact of that weed is about $22 million a year, primarily because it grows on mud flats and it destroys, you know, important feeding habitat for shorebirds. So we do have data in the Department of Ag study that demonstrates that there is both economic and ecological impacts of these weeds. So there is harm. We recently did a survey of 20 lakes on the Oregon coast around Florence, which is one of the, you know, lots of lakes in the Florence vicinity. We surveyed 20 lakes, and we found at least one non-indigenous species or weed in 100% of the lakes that had a boat ramp had weeds. Of those lakes that didn't have boat ramps, only 22% had an introduced plant. So by that calculation, by that survey, it suggests that a lake with a boat ramp is five times more likely to be infested by noxious weeds. So we do have data, and it's pretty well understood that lakes with boat ramps, because the boat trailers are how these weeds are transported, tend to be more infested by these noxious weeds, and they do have economic impacts. I think the rest of my comments are pretty much covered by other people. I think this bill doesn't solve the problem of aquatic weed spread and dispersal in the state. Obviously, the 20% of the lakes that we surveyed had weeds and didn't have a boat ramp. So there's another pathway. One of them is aquatic gardeners and aquarists. There are educational programs in place to sort of get at those people and to tell them not to release their plants and animals into the waterways. We have our sign program. The Invasive Species Council is developing a public awareness campaign. We did a recent survey and found that we surveyed 503 Oregonians in a telephone survey, and about 71% thought already that invasive species are a concern. That was the question. Is this a concern? And 71% said, yeah. So that tells us, well, people already kind of get it. Maybe we don't have to educate them about the concern, why they should be concerned. We need to tell them what to do. So that's kind of the point of the sign, which shows people pulling weeds off the boats. People are concerned. Here's what to do if you are concerned. So there are a number of activities going on in the state. The Invasive Species Council, as I mentioned, has this outreach campaign that we're developing. The Department of Ag has a pretty active weed program. And at Portland State, we run an aquatic nuisance species management plan that we developed for the state that includes a lot of outreach and management, that sort of thing.
Thank you, Mark. Very helpful. Yes, Representative.
I just have to say it was about 1994, I think. I was doing a little volunteer work for candidate Governor Kitzhaber at the time, and my assignment was to attend a presentation you gave in CSUN.
Oh, yes,
and
I remember that.
How could someone talk for 5 hours on lakes? And he did, and it was fascinating. I learned more about lakes. So here you are again. Thank you. It was very interesting.
I hate to ask this question, but you're going to have to forgive me. You know, early in your testimony, especially which I'm sure I'll mispronounce this, but Egeria densa, or something close to that, sounds like it's everywhere now. And my question is, once again, I hate to ask the question, Mr. Chair, is it too late? I mean, are we creating a law to prevent something that's already done, and maybe we ought to look to affect it in the lake as opposed to the transportation?
Well, that one of the problems is there isn't much you can do once they're here. Our herbicide use in aquatic systems in this state is very difficult to do. Some of the other mechanical means for controlling these weeds are extremely expensive and also have ecological impacts on fish, for example, fish populations. So in some cases, the cats or horses out of the barn or the cats out of the bag or however you want it, the plants are everywhere. Mm-hmm. And when those widespread plants, the only real solution long term is some biocontrol agent. We need to find something that will eat it and not eat anything else. And at this point, we haven't had a lot of luck. There is some research in South America to look for insects that eat that particular plant. So there's ongoing activity. It's not only in Oregon, it's also in California. It's a really widespread plant, Agaridensa. There are other plants that we don't have that aren't here yet or that are not very widespread. And that's really what this will deal with are those species like hydrilla, which is an A-listed noxious weed present in Washington and California. We don't have it in Oregon at all, as far as we know. Trapanatans and other species like that. Lagrosiphon, I could give you a list as long as my arm or longer of plants that we don't have that this bill would prevent their spread if it were to infest one particularly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Very, very helpful.
Thank you.
Rich?
Good afternoon. I am actually not here representing construction materials and rocks. I am here representing my favorite pastime, which is duck hunting. And I just picked this bill up this morning and started thinking about it. And it made me aware, real quick, Rich Angstrom, I'm not sure if I should give an address since I'm testifying on a personal matter. But my concern is that this bill will probably make the entire duck hunting community illegal as soon as it comes out. And I'm concerned about that from a couple of perspectives, and I want to give you some examples. I have three duck boats. Actually, I have four counting my canoe. Three of them are set up for holding different kinds of vegetation for camouflage for duck hunting that I do. One of them is a $10,000 boat I had brought over from Maine, and it's specifically designed to hold brush species, you know, different kinds of vegetation for camouflage purposes. The duck hunting community doesn't disagree there's a problem. In fact, we try to police our own on this a little bit. Spartina and reed canary grass are two particular problems that we see out on the marshes quite a bit. And there's quite an effort, and it takes a great expense to try to eradicate those things. And the other issue that I should point out is duck hunters probably use a broad range of stuff, including things around their yard. I use stuff that my wife, you know, cuts for flowers, different kinds of things that I'll bind up and put on the boat. Cattails is something that's common. Willows is common. Different kinds of native reeds and things like that the duck hunting community puts on. It actually fastens onto their boat and usually keeps them there in many circumstances for the entire season as they brush their boat up and tie everything on. Good duck hunters obviously try to get plants that aren't going to be invasive. That's my practice. But all of you know, I wouldn't be able to do the practice that I normally do. So. And then the third point that I think is important is there's a whole industry out there that takes cattails and weaves them. If you went down to Sportsman Warehouse, you'd walk in and look at the different types of camouflage that they use for boats, and they actually harvest stuff and now manufacture it for covering boats. And that's an aquatic vegetative species that would fall in within the purview of this particular law. My recommendation to this committee and to the agencies that have to handle this is that I think that they need to identify the species. For duck hunters, it's going to be primarily reed canary grass and spartina, and you know other boaters it may be something else. But for the duck hunting community, those certainly are going to be at least two important species. With that, then the Marine Board now has a requirement that we all have to test and about boat safety. And I think this should then be part of the test, that they are able to identify and know that there are certain types of weeds that we do not want spread. And then we ought to make those specific types unlawful that when they're intentionally transported. And I think from the duck hunting community, you'd hear quite a bit of support for that kind of idea. Most duck hunters are pretty good about knowing what the species are that they're putting on their boat. And most of them know which ones are the problems. But a little education and then with a little bit of a stick that's very specific, not broad, doesn't make illegal those kinds of species that they're not worried about, I think is probably the appropriate approach. This is too broad from my view. It picks up both natural and man-made types of materials that doesn't make sense for to be covered. So with that, I conclude the first time I've testified on a personal matter in 8 years in the Capitol. Thank you.
Thanks, Rich. Questions?
Any questions?
No, guess not.
All right.
Thank you. I see an amendment already forming over there.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, again, State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. The Director of the Marine Board just pointed out to me that there is an exemption in the Minnesota law for duck hunting type of boats. And whatever is appropriate here in terms of language, wordsmithing, again, the idea is that we want people to be very cognizant that when they're removing their boats from the water, whatever green, fresh vegetation is hanging off of it probably ought to stay there around that waterway and not go down the road. That's what we're trying to accomplish here. And again, I'm happy to work with anyone to find a way to achieve that, even if it means not passing a law. Thank you,
okay,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anyone else to testify on 2576? I'll close the public hearing on 2576. And I think we have one more bill floating around here somewhere. It's open a public hearing on 2586. And John, a little summary.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill would provide additional fines and driving privilege suspensions when certain right-of-way violations result in injury, serious injury, or fatalities to an individual other than the person who committed the offense. The bill specifically identifies 11 different types of offenses to which the additional fine and suspension provisions would apply. They include things, for example, like failure to yield a right-of-way at an uncontrolled intersection or a T-intersection or roundabout when an individual is merging or an individual that makes what would be defined as a dangerous left turn. The additional fine and suspension for a violation causing an injury would be an additional $200 and a 30-day suspension, a minimum of $500 and 3 months if a serious injury results, and $1,000 and 6 months if a fatality results.
Thanks, John. Representative Flores had intended to be here, but she can't because her husband's having surgery today. So first up, Brenda Trainer.
Mr. Chairman, representatives on the committee, I want to first thank you for having these hearings. It's been a while since I've been down in Salem and participated, but I really do appreciate being able to do this. My name is Brenda Trainer Huber, and I'm a native Oregonian. The pictures that I've got for you describing, I thought it might be easy for you once I read this that you can see the situation I was in. I'm a former defensive driving instructor, and I've been riding a motorcycle almost 10 years. And my father was a police officer. So in emergency situations, I've been well trained. On July 26, 2003, was a hot 97-degree day. My husband and I decided to wait until after dinner to go for a motorcycle ride to try and cool down a little bit. We had headed out to Estacada, and we decided we would cross the Carver Bridge to the south side and make a left turn to head east on Springwater Road. If you'll notice the pictures of my motorcycle, you'll see that distance-wise across, it's 56 inches total from to the wheelbase, and the length of it is about 10 foot. Coming off the Carver Bridge is a T-intersection with the stop signs on east and westbound traffic. My husband was ahead of me on his 2000 FXD, and I was close behind on my Intruder trike. There was quite a bit of traffic, but everybody was moving smoothly. In fact, as we approached our turn, there was a light blue van that had not stopped at the stop line. And as we approached, Randy managed to get around her, even though she was hanging over the stop line. As I approached her, she was over the stop line more, and she rolled forward as she looked into my eyes. I've managed to avoid being hit by her, and I ended up in the ditch. I lost control of my motorcycle because on the one side, I don't know if you can see it very well on the one photograph, there's a ditch there, and it drops, the pavement drops off. For a short period of time, I felt like I was airborne, and apparently that's the way I looked to everybody who described it to me, because I had one wheel in the ditch and everything else was up here. I had absolute no control. When my trike dropped down onto the pavement, it was gravel, and gravel with trikes, motorcycles, even four-wheel drives, it's uncontrollable. I was fortunate that there wasn't anyone parked in the parking lot. There was someone parked next to the building, but not in the parking lot. I flew across, and between the two signposts, I managed to aim my trike through there. And I ended up hitting the vine-covered granite embankment. I had stillness, and then I opened my eyes and thanked the Lord that I was still here. And I smelled gas. I hit the kill switch, which we all have on our motorcycles, but still smelled gas. I remember seeing my husband and some other people running up to me and trying to take my trike off of me. They rolled it off of me. On page number 3, there is two X's right next to that post. One on the inside. The one on the inside indicates that there's a very small telephone box there. And between the distance between it is the distance of my body width. I was trapped between that telephone pole and that phone box. And there's no place else to go. Within 5 minutes, Clackamas County Sheriff was on the scene. He was at a park close by. He asked me how much I had to drink and how fast I was going. I hadn't had a drink since 1987, and I wasn't going over 15 miles an hour in my trike. In fact, I can take a corner doing 20 miles an hour. Two more officers showed up and both repeated the same questions. I assumed that they would gather information from witnesses, but there was only one report made, and it was a report that I had to make about the accident. After getting snapshots, our partner asked at the tavern there if anyone had seen what had happened. He did get a statement from the tavern keeper. She had come out to see what all the commotion was about and saw this woman with her van halfway over the stop line and asked her to pull into the parking lot and the vehicle behind her. And this is what I've been told afterwards because I don't remember much. She didn't. And I assumed the police would go and find her, and they had no interest to it. In fact, they can't. It's up to their discretion anytime there's a single vehicle involved. She didn't stop at the stop sign. And because of this, I have ongoing expenses still. So far, this has cost me $50,000. And my uninsured motorist, thank God, paid for most of that. But a lot of it's coming out of our pocket. If my husband had not started a full-time job and had been covered by Kaiser hospitalization, I would not have the medical care I still have to have. My leg didn't start healing until November of 2004, and this was July of 2003 that my accident happened. I'm open to any questions anyone has for me.
Questions?
I'm interested in the law that would, or that whatever the police have the discretion to investigate further or not, because often, and I know you guys are tired of hearing me say I'm a firefighter, but you know, and Roger, yeah, he's my constituent from Hamlet. He knows what the road's like there on 26, and often someone will do something and it causes an accident, and in most cases, people do know that they've done something, mm-hmm. and sometimes they'll take off. It's not like they're involved in the accident and they're leaving the scene. So I guess that's my question there, is if you were able to follow up on that at all, with if you had an attorney or anything.
I talked to attorneys and they just told me the same thing, that the officers, it's up to their discretion whether they want any get any information. They talked to witnesses. I know that, but that's all they did. They didn't write anything down.
And follow up. I mean, maybe that's something that we need to follow up on, because in so many cases, I mean, thank God it wasn't a yeah. head-on or something like that, but you hit another vehicle. It's bad enough what you did. But I really feel strongly about that. When someone causes an accident or does something that causes an accident to happen, whether or not they meant it or not, in that case, it kind of sounds like she did do something wrong, and nobody followed up on it because she wasn't actually involved in it. But if someone does that, I think it's like they were involved in the accident. They just happened to not be touched by it personally, but caused someone else to be touched by it. I don't know if anybody knows anything about that. And you don't have any policemen or...
Brenda, how would this law change the situation with you?
Well, I believe that at the time, if the law was enacted, that the police possibly would have gone after her, because everyone said this woman was out in the middle of the road. There's no space there. I mean, you get a T intersection like this one was, and there is just nowhere to go. And the man behind me, I do remember him coming and saying, I could not have done that. And, yeah, I think I could have possibly had the police go after her, because it financially it really hurt my husband and I really, really bad. We struggled through this. He was working through a temp agency at the time, and we got insurance from them, but they only paid $400 for the emergency. That was it. That's all they covered. So, and I'm still, like I said, recovering. I have a unit on me. It's called an EBI unit, and it's to help my bone keep growing. I have a 13-inch titanium rod in my leg, and I was really, I don't know, it's just, I really was disappointed that the police didn't want to help me more. That I grew up a police officer's daughter, and it was always, you know, you take care of business and then you can fall apart. And at the time it was like, I was stuck. I couldn't ask people questions. And I really depended on the police to at least get some names for me so that I could give information to my insurance company. Because they still, if I ever see this person, they still want to find out, you know, license number, and come back on her if they can. Any more questions?
Yeah, further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I hope you'll support this bill.
Ken Ray.
Good afternoon. Chair Gilman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Ray. I'm executive director of Bike Pack of Oregon. We were the organization that requested this bill to be sponsored by Representative Flores. And actually, I handed you all of my written testimony. I forgot to keep the one for me. If I can ask your indulgence on that. I'm sure you only hear that about a lot, right? Thank you. So, anyway, Bike Pack has asked for this bill for a simple reason. It's needed. Right-of-way violations are unfortunately not always treated the same. If there's been some very well-publicized cases that have happened in the last few years involving motorcyclists where their right-of-way was violated by another motor vehicle. One happened in Portland. It was a motor officer, and he was struck by a 19-year-old girl who made a mistake and unfortunately will pay for that. It was well prosecuted, and it was something that was taken very seriously. The person who committed the act was treated probably very appropriately for the situation. But all too often that doesn't happen. And all too often it is either treated as if the motorcyclist should not have been on the motorcycle in the first place, so therefore, you know, that's what happens. Or, unfortunately, the fines and penalties that can be gone after for somebody who violates a right-of-way are so small that a prosecuting attorney goes after the low-hanging fruit, which is something that's a little bigger, a little more fine. I'm not here to suggest that changing the law so that right-of-way violations are penalized more heavily or treated more seriously will solve all the problems or make everybody a better driver. However, it will add another tool in something that motorcyclists are especially vulnerable at. I've been riding motorcycles for over 20 years. I've spoke to many of you about motorcycling issues in the past, but the fact remains that motorcycling, despite what many people say, I maintain is not dangerous, but we are vulnerable. And we are vulnerable because we do have only our skills and our motorcycles handling to keep us out of trouble many times. Unfortunately, on stop signs, four-way intersections, and people who decide to turn left in front of you, all your skills and all your training and all your alacrity at handling your motorcycle may not make a difference. And in that case, it's time for penalties and for any other violation where somebody has caused injury or caused death. It's quite offensive to the riding community when that happens and the person either receives no fine or a minor fine. It was also, I hearken back to a story that was in the news great in a national setting. It was a congressman, Jenklow, in South Dakota, who ran a stop sign and wiped out a motorcyclist, killed him, and he was eventually had to leave the Congress because of that. There was a lot of publicity there because of who he was, but it could have been anybody, and it could have been somebody who was a little less publicity. There's a good chance that that person in that state would have paid very little penalty for that. We had hoped to have, see if Sam makes it. I have him on the witness testimony. Sam is an attorney who represents a lot of motorcycles in these cases, can answer a lot of the questions you had. But like all attorneys, he was running really late, and he's trying to get down here. So I'm hoping he can answer some of those. If not, we'll try to follow up with that later. I realize it'll still be up to prosecuting attorneys to charge negligent vehicle operators, and that's appropriate. We hope that the legislature, showing that they take this violation of right-of-way on the road seriously, will encourage more enforcement by local courts. I'm hopefully encouraging more drivers to think and look twice for all vehicles on the road. And I thank you for your time. As the weather gets better, my last statement here is watch out for motorcycles, and that May is Motorcycle Awareness Month. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time. Oh, I'm sorry. Back up one thing. There's a -1 amendment out that we also support to clean up one bit of language, which was outside of our our intent. The way the bill was written, it said that the offense took place in, the suspense would happen, the suspension of the driver's license or the penalties, and that if the license was suspended, that would only be on the vehicle that they were in when the offense occurred. the dash one would clean that up. We didn't intend that if somebody ran into somebody in a pickup truck that they could hop in the Mazda and take off. We meant for it to be a driver's license suspension. Thank you. Now I'll be happy to answer any questions if you haven't.
Thank you, Ken. Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Speaking of the licensing, how I read the original bill was that, for instance, if they were committed the offense while driving a vehicle, they weren't necessarily suspended from their, you know, driving a semi truck or something. Was that what you intended originally or not? You just meant all.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we intended that the same way that the legislature and courts have decided that driving is a privilege, that if somebody, that privilege would be rescinded for that period of time. Now, the question is how that impacts, you're talking about impacts vocations where driving is part of the vocation. I don't have a good answer for that, but if I could defer that question to Wayne Schumacher, who's planning to speak in a few minutes, I'm sure he can answer that better because he's more versed with the technical aspects of that. I'm kind of punning, but it's because I just don't know the answer 100%.
Okay. Well, I do have more questions, but I'm
absolutely
not sure if maybe it should be for the attorney that's on his way. I can't remember his name. I just have to tell you, and I'm feeling like a heel for saying this because my gut just is stopping me on this one for some reason. And I rode with my parents growing up. They each had bikes, and we would go all over. But I guess my hesitancy is perhaps the bill lumps people with a reckless disregard for the safety of others in with people who have made an honest mistake. Do you see it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I don't, because there is still, somebody would still have to be convicted, which means they would have to go through the court process, and either the judge or a jury, depending on how it was done, would have to determine that had happened. It is not, just because somebody's issued a citation does not mean automatically that they would fall under that. And again, that is in the case of serious injury or death, which is injuries already defined, I believe, under statute. But the person would still have to be convicted. So that's a pretty high standard, in my opinion, and an appropriate standard.
Another one?
Yes, please. So convicted, I guess I'm confused maybe a little bit between citation and conviction, and I'll just back that up with a little story of when I was 17 and driving while brainless. And it was essentially I got a little bit lost and saw a place to turn around, but I was in the left lane, and it was on, you know, I'd have to be in the right lane to get there. So I was sitting in a light anticipating I would get over there real quick and do that. I was driving a vehicle where I couldn't necessarily see, you know, Chevy Malibu, the rear window kind of goes up. You couldn't really see out that way. I looked at my rear view. I did due diligence in making my lane change, but there's this little zippy Porsche. My parents were really happy about that on their insurance. Coming down the down the lane, and I had cut him off. I didn't realize, didn't see him. He just, as far as I was concerned, came out of nowhere, and I felt like horrible, depressed for months on that one. But just substitute now, I mean, I was given a ticket for an improper lane change, and the officer was kind enough to tell me that I could have gotten a ticket for reckless driving. I thought, well, okay, improper lane change sounds pretty darn good. That would come in this bill. Now, if that had been a motorcycle, the likelihood of him or this driver being seriously injured or killed is significantly increased, and the same offense would suddenly be this being possibly, you know, being having a license suspension and all that. And I guess maybe that's where I'm putting on my brakes. I just feel like I did what I could, and had some the circumstances been just a tiny bit different, it could have really gone the other way. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's a question or not, but
well,
maybe that's where my hesitancy is coming
from. Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I understand what you're saying, and I would put it in this kind of analogy. If you were in your standard size automobile and suddenly had your right-of-way violated by a Class A 42-foot motorhome, that does not diminish the fact that you're in a smaller vehicle, that you had the right to that lane. And if that motorhome had violated your right-of-way and that person was issued a citation, that doesn't mean that they are automatically convicted. They have the right to go to court, offer testimony, and the judge, or it's not a jury case because it is just a traffic infraction, but they have the right to offer a defense, and the judge may not find them guilty. And in the case of what you were talking about due diligence, I mean, I've seen been a long time since, I shouldn't say that, I received my first traffic citation for the first time in about 8 years and went to court over it. And my perception of the judge was that he was very fair. And he listened to the facts and gave a person a defense, and some people were able to successfully defend their case and some were not. And that's why we have the system we have. What is objectionable to me is that a police officer doesn't issue a citation when one should be, and therefore it now has to be treated as a civil matter and has to be sued to recover what should be something that could happen under justice. It's not even the dollars. And again, I'm hoping that Councillor Hochberg can show up, because he did provide some written testimony, which I brought down knowing that he may have a time conflict. And it mentions that many, many people that he's represented, it's not even the money. It's the fact that they feel that justice was denied, mm-hmm. because the person never had any penalty to them whatsoever.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ken. Sam Hochberg.
That's the one.
Oh, Sam. Okay. Okay. Oh, Wayne, I guess you're up then.
For the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher, and I'm here today representing Bike Pack of Oregon. And I have no written testimony. I was hoping to basically help Mr. Hochberg, but maybe can answer some of the technical questions. This bill is not designed to protect motorcyclists. It's not designed to protect bicyclists. It's designed to protect every citizen's driving in the state of Oregon, and it was specifically written that way. And again, to echo Mr. Ray's comments, maybe in your question, Representative Thatcher, it's the issue of once a citation is issued, then obviously they have to go to court and defend their actions, and that's where we seem to go awry. One of the things I might be able to offer is we're getting a lot of willful violations, running red lights, failure to stop, failure to yield. It's becoming literally epidemic, and there have been a number of things that communities have tried to do, including the cameras at the stoplights, which are somewhat in question, I guess. But the specific issue that I'd like to address is, it seems almost consistent, and maybe Mr. Hochberg could address this better than I, but what we're finding is that police officers often don't issue a citation where they can because they feel that the sentencing or the penalty is inconsistently applied in the courts, and therefore if they have a feeling, and if they've been burned a couple of times where they've issued a citation and it's basically been dismissed in court, or they've been handed a $15, a $10, a $20 fine, they feel, you know, it hasn't really even supported the amount of dollars it's taken for that officer to show up. We have a real problem, and maybe Representative Thatcher can address this. I believe there was an informational hearing earlier this session before the Judiciary Committee where there was a concern registered and extensive testimony on inconsistency in sentences of judges across the state. And really, that's what the intent of this bill is. Whether or not it's a bicyclist that's had their right-of-way violated, and I don't know if you're aware of it or not, even a disabled person in a motorized cart can commit a violation of right-of-way against a pedestrian on a sidewalk. We made sure that was not involved in this legislation, which actually did come out of LC originally. But it was to address the issues of no matter whether it's a four-wheel vehicle, a motorhome, a bicyclist, or a motorcyclist, those which are the most egregious violations is what we picked out here, and I worked directly with legislative counsel to make sure that those were the ones that were picked out and targeted. And so, and again, the Dash 1 amendment, I worked with Mr. Hauser. We had discovered, as Mr. Ray had indicated, that an intent was kind of misdirected, so the Dash 1 amendments were devised, and we're asking that you support those as well. And if I'm not mistaken, just for informational purposes, and Mr. Hauser can correct me if I'm incorrect on this, but I believe there's a subsequent referral to a Judiciary Committee on this particular bill. That terminates my statement. I would be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions?
Thank you. I guess you were here when I explained my scenario when I was 17. Now, under that scenario, I got a citation. I went to the Multnomah County Circuit, or whatever it was, downtown, trying to at least get it reduced. That's what I did. Now, if this happened and this bill was in place, would I have to then have employed a defense attorney automatically, or... That's kind of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, not necessarily, no. I mean, it's just like any other traffic violation. If you'd received a citation for speeding or something like that, you have the option of showing up and having your day in court. You can be represented by an attorney or not. It doesn't place it in a requirement for that. It's an option.
Thank you. Now, as a... I guess I do still have this problem on my mind, differentiating between the citation and the conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you get the citation. That's what gets you to court to begin with, or you pay the fine mm-hmm. currently. The conviction would mean that, yeah, it looks like he was correct in issuing that citation. Is that what the conviction means?
Yeah, it basically would become before a judge. The judge would hear the case. You would be able to give your side of the story. Obviously, the officer would probably be present to give their side. Also, the person who might have been injured would have the opportunity, obviously, of showing up as well. So everybody can give their particular side of the story, and then the judge makes a determination. It typically would not be involved a jury or anything of that nature, although you could push it that direction, I suppose, if you chose to do so.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks, Wayne. Anyone else testify on 2586? Close the hearing on 2586. And I think we've completed our work. John, have you got anything else?
No.
Okay.
Comment, because I was the only one here that made it to the hearing in Bend. Representative Burley chaired it, and we had Senator Westland sit in with us. And it was a really good hearing. I made it over the pass, and it was well attended, and I just wanted to report back to you how many people were there. I mean, it filled a room, I think, a little bit bigger than this. We had a lot of people. Well, John was there. He knows. How many people do you think?
Probably between 50 and 60, maybe.
Yeah, quite a few. Anyway, it was really nice to do that. And I guess my comment on it is I'm hearing a lot of other committees are going around the state, and we're hitting the east side really hard, which is good because I have heard some comments from the Peanut Gallery via other people who are out there and saying, we never thought we'd ever see this. And they appreciate us coming over there because it's hard to get over here for some people. And this committee was heard at 2 o'clock until 4:30 on a Friday. And then the next day, we went over to Baker City, and that was a Saturday, and we had a hearing from 3 to 5 or 6 in the afternoon, and it was well attended. So, and that was the Health and Human Services Committee. So anyway, I think that the people of Oregon are getting a little treat this session, and they like it. So that's my 2 cents.
Any other comments? This meeting's adjourned.